Hi there, global citizens. Welcome back to the podcast that inspires a borderless mindset around manifesting a new world. I am your host, Florence Adu, coming to you from a lovely Accra morning. It's just been an interesting week. Things just are falling into place as they should. And so I feel like that's great energy to go into this conversation with my guest that I discovered watching a forum. Like I do all this, I think you all know, I do all this kind of, not alternative, but all kinds of different research. And so I came across a discussion she had on a psychedelic assisted therapy global summit, I believe. And they actually just had another one, which I saw a different discussion that she had. So that's kind of nice to bring it full circle right at this moment. And so let's get to her bio. She is a mental health futurist and has spent her early career reimagining effective mental health care in the medical system. Her clinical interests focus on ethical care in psychedelic sessions, examining ways culture informs how we diagnose and treat mental illness. Before joining the Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College in London as a psychedelic research therapist in psychopharmacology, she participated as a study therapist with the MDMA therapy for PTSD clinical trial sponsored by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which is MAPS. While working with MAPS, she advocated for health equity in psychedelic therapy and co-led the first ever MAPS MDMA-assisted psychotherapy training for clinicians of color. In addition to her appointment at Imperial College, she is co-founder and curriculum development specialist with the Women's Global Empowerment Initiative, as well as founder and creative executive at Mind's Eye Health Solutions, where she co-facilitates psilocybin truffle retreats in the Netherlands and works in private practice with patients with mood and anxiety disorders using ketamine as an adjunct to psychotherapy. She lectures on topics fusing culturally sensitive practices with psychedelic assisted therapy and advises organizations on anti-oppressive and inclusive practices. Sarah Reed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Florence, for having me. I look forward to our conversation today.
Okay, wonderful. So let's get started. Where are you from? Where are you local? And what is your craft?
I am from a small country town in the state of Kentucky in the United States, a small town called Hopkinsville. I am currently living in London, England. And what is my craft? Whew. If I could concisely attempt to define what my craft is, I would say it's helping people have a different experience of themselves in the world.
That's a beautiful craft. Yeah. Because I think what we often don't recognize is that another experience is possible. Mm-hmm. And so I love that that is what you're focused on, is helping people realize another experience is possible. So yeah, mm-hmm. Nice. Okay. So we know a lot about London. So my listeners always want to know a little bit more about what is your London. So where is your London where you are?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I am currently based in South Croydon. So okay. Shout out to the folks in South London. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mostly stay at home because that is, as Tabitha Brown says, my business. I also commute to work to West London about a couple times a week to engage in psychedelic research work.
Okay. So this is a good time to ask why the where. So how did you come to be living, working, and playing where you currently are located?
Oh, so why the where is because I found love in the pandemic. Mm. So what this story is, so I'll go back to 2020. And I was living in the States, in the state of Connecticut. And at this time, psychedelic research had been put on hold. And at the clinic that I was working at, we were going to be part of the MDMA therapy for PTSD's expanded access program. And so because of COVID, everything got halted and delayed. So as many folks thought about during COVID. I was left questioning, like, what is my purpose? Why am I doing what I'm doing? And for me at the time, the call was to go back home to Kentucky and set up a practice there, get a farm, live my life, and, you know, not look back to psychedelic research, but maybe just still work with ketamine. And, you know, this may not be the most professional story to share, but it is the truth of my story, which is I had a friend at the time. We both just got out of terrible relationships. And so she was living in London at the time. And she's like, girl, let's get on Hinge, this dating app called Hinge. And so she helped to support me making a Hinge profile. Mind you, I made a Hinge profile while I was in Kentucky, but I set my location to London. Mm-hmm. Another conversation for another day. But I will say, after about 3 weeks of me being on that app, I met my now fiance, who's born and raised in London, but parents, and ethnically, he's from Nigeria.
Okay.
And so, you know, I was like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, explore life in London. And with the work that I was doing at the time, I really had the flexibility to do so. But then I was like, oh, I need to get a job so that I can get a skilled worker visa here, mm-hmm. Or at least a worker visa here. So thankfully, I was able to be employed through Imperial College London, where I'm now the lead psychedelic research therapist.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. And I hear Hinge is great for that. So it's the app that's meant to get you off the app. So you've done well.
Exactly. Highly recommend to anybody who is searching for love.
Yeah. Okay. So Imperial College. So let's start where you are now a little bit. So you were able to find that, but it took your experience of work and your body of work to actually put you in a position to be that lead in that space. And so what was that process like, and how did it differ from your previous experiences?
Yeah, 100% that my past work experience really supported me in being able to get employment as a psychedelic research therapist here. And yeah, I'll share a little about my origin story to psychedelics, and we'll maybe go on a few tangents, but, you know, I'll come back to your question. So my origin story truly starts, I would say, being divinely pushed in this space. And I say divinely pushed because I was not interested at all in becoming a therapist, let alone a psychedelic research therapist. I had no idea what that meant 6 years ago, well, like 10 years ago now, I'll say. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, in 2013, I went through a pretty difficult year where I experienced a lot of loss, and one being a miscarried child. And so that experience really catalyzed me to also ask, or to go back to my usual coping mechanisms of not dealing with emotions that I'm not ready to deal with. And so for me, what that looked like was work. So I worked myself to avoid the grief that I was experiencing. And at that point, I did the only thing that I knew how to do, which was to pray. Like, what I'm doing is not working. So I asked God, I said, Lord, if you can get me out of the situation and help me deal with this grief, I will surrender to whatever it is that you have for my life. And maybe about a month after I said that prayer, I heard the whisper of marriage and family therapy. And I'm like, marriage and family therapy? Remember, God, I don't like mental health is not my jam. I don't want to go into Western medicine, anything related to Western medicine. But I remembered I had to uphold my end of the sacred bargain. So that journey led me to complete a master's degree in marriage and family therapy. And then I was still resistant at the completion of that degree. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do therapy, though. I'm here for learning more about human behavior, but I really didn't want to practice. But long story short, or long story longer, I then connected with Dr. Monica Williams at her clinic, which was in Kentucky at the time, where the focus was on mood and anxiety disorders, but also a specific population that was treated at her clinic was folks who experienced race-based trauma. And so that was quite fulfilling for me. And then MAPS reached out to Monica, and because they recognized that their participant pool for MDMA therapy for PTSD was overwhelmingly white, right, from a racial demographic perspective. And so they're like, if we're serious about bringing this drug-assisted treatment through FDA approval, we need someone to help us diversify our participant pools. Mm-hmm. So they reached out to Monica. Monica then asked if I wanted to go to my first MAPS training, and I said yes. And I said yes for a couple of reasons. One, because I remembered from my grandma, my mother, that I understood the concept that plants are medicinal, or you can use plants to heal. They weren't using psychoactive plants, but more like aloe vera, the plant aloe vera to put on a burn. And I also remembered the work of Dr. Gabor Maté on using ayahuasca to help folks in treating addiction. And so from there, I got trained through MAP, saw a participant in the MDMA therapy protocol or MDMA therapy trial. I was at Yale University for a short amount of time and helped to support or helped to contribute to their psilocybin for depression therapy manual. Also worked with ketamine, then pandemic hit and went back to Kentucky, then came to London. Mm. And so, yeah, my work now is really focused on therapy development and really exploring these questions of what do participants respond well to in drug-assisted and non-drug psychedelic sessions? How can we create a safe container for these medicines in this medicalized space? And how do these non-pharmacological factors like a person's race, gender, sexual orientation, ability, etc., how do all of these factors shape the type of journey that participants have? And how can we as practitioners help support participants in meeting these parts of themselves in these expanded states of consciousness?
So many questions, so many. Okay. So the first question, primarily for my listeners, is can you take us through what are the psychedelic tools that are in practice or in play typically that you're using?
Mm-hmm. So I'll speak to the medicines or the substances that I mainly use. And I say substances over medicines because if we're specifically talking in a medicalized setting, we can't call them medicines until they've gone through drug approval, even though we know that they can be medicinal. But nonetheless, MDMA is one substance. Ketamine is another. Psilocybin is another. LSD, as well as DMT. That these are some examples of psychedelic substances that are being used or tested or trial to see if they can be of any use to folks who suffer from different mental health conditions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so MDMA, on the street, we know that as ecstasy.
Uh-huh,
And so when you're using MDMA, first of all, I'm curious about what plant relationship MDMA has.
Yes. I get excited for this question because there was one point in my journey where I didn't recognize that all of these synthetic molecules or synthetic medicines that we're creating in the lab have their origins somewhere in nature, whether it's a plant, whether it's a fungi, whether it's something.
Right.
And for MDMA, what I've been taught is that the molecule or the plant derivative is sassafras.
Mm. So sassafras. That goes so way back. Oh my gosh. Now I get it. I was okay. Mm-hmm. Sassafras. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And psilocybin, of course, is one of the molecules that can be found in magic mushrooms. With ketamine, I forget the name of the fungi, but there is a naturally occurring fungi that you can find in nature that, again, a derivative of that can be made through or ketamine is made from that compound.
Sure. And then DMT is a plant. So, and it's in various different types of plants. The, you know, iboga, I think, and also ayahuasca and a number of other ones. Okay. So all of these plants and then LSD. So the question is LSD. So is LSD have this, what are the plant origins of LSD? Are there? Cause it's, you know, that was known as acid. And so I wonder if that was always synthetic and it was just part of the group.
Yes. Yeah, so I am not sure what the plant derivative of LSD is because I haven't done that research, but I would like to say that there is some plant, some derivative that exists in plant or in fungi in nature. I just don't know. And scientists will, I had this debate with one of my executive leaders recently about the differences between synthetic medicines and the plant derivatives. And scientists will try to say that, oh, well, if it's literally synthesized in a lab, that it doesn't have any plant-based origins, but that is just not true. That all of these medicines that we know of, they are derived from what we know in nature.
Sure. Okay. So in thinking about how, because, you know, one of the things that I learned in the summit recently is that the psychedelic therapy movement is quite organized. So though it's this kind of off, has been this kind of other type of place, it's pretty organized. And so thinking about globally how these practices are becoming just much more institutionalized and becoming much more of a place of real serious healing or medicine, what are your thoughts on how that is, what the business argument has been around that? And how that changes the real, because the healthcare profession, look, so I feel like the healthcare industry co-opts so many things because of the money. And so in this space, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about where, when money enters, what is the outcome?
Cool. What I have seen in this space since I've been in it, which is about 7 years, is that psychedelic medicines are becoming more of an industry. It's more of the psychedelic medicine industry. And what that means is that in Western society in particular, that I've seen businesses trying to exploit certain aspects of the molecule to achieve certain desirable effects. We're exploiting the plants, exploiting the medicines because they can see a pharmaceutical opportunity to make lots of money. Mm-hmm. One challenge that we have currently in the field is around accessibility, in that if these drug-assisted therapies get approved, like MDMA therapy, for example, getting approved in the States, and mind you, Australia already has approved MDMA therapy and psilocybin-assisted therapy. But specifically, speaking about the States, if MDMA therapy gets approved, the cost that has been projected for a patient to complete treatment with MDMA therapy is literally in the tens of thousands of dollars. So it's like, there's lots of questions of, well, who are these drug-assisted therapies for? Because most of my clients, if not all of my clients, are not going to be able to afford a $20,000 treatment for MDMA therapy. And I know that there's insurance is trying to be an avenue to help mitigate some of the costs, the out-of-pocket costs that folks have. But particularly in the United States, not everybody has insurance. So what about this demographic of folks, which, yeah, I am someone who hasn't been insured in the United States for a very long time. And so it's like, what are going to be the models of care that we can use to support in creating access to psychedelic-assisted therapy? That we've got a long way to go in the medical model when it comes to really making psychedelic-assisted therapies more accessible. And I personally believe that if we truly want to talk about accessibility in meaningful ways, that the medical model is not going to be the only route. It will be a route to getting or working with psychedelics. But yeah, those are some of the thoughts I have.
I hear you. It makes a lot of sense. And so kind of thinking about that, how do you determine which substance that you apply to your clients and treatment? So what are kind of like, in what cases do you use MDMA? What cases use ketamine, psilocybin?
So right now, legal use or board regulations determine what medicines you can use for what. So for example, if MDMA-assisted psychotherapy gets approved, it will be used for PTSD, so trauma for MDMA. Whereas ketamine, it is legal to use. It's a legal drug to use, but many practitioners use that in an off-label way to treat a variety of mental health conditions. Like, it could be PTSD, but it also could be anxiety or depression. And yeah, I'll just maybe say that for now, because there's also been a ketamine approved medication called Spravato that is covered by insurance, but that's a different pathway to using ketamine than using ketamine, say, orally or via an infusion. Psilocybin is being tested for a lot of conditions now. So psilocybin for depression, psilocybin for addiction. There are a couple studies that we will be starting at Imperial College where we'll be testing how well psilocybin or if psilocybin can be of any use for folks with gambling addiction and opioid use disorder. So there's, depending on the country, depending on the setting, whether it's research, clinical, or retreat, that the setting and the legalities, I would say, also influence what medicines you can use for what. But I'm hopeful that once the field continues to evolve, that we will start to see more like MDMA being used, say, for depression, or psilocybin being used to treat PTSD, that there'll be less restrictions on what medicines you can use.
Right, right. So it sounds like, unfortunately, it is going the way of pharmaceuticals, right? So in order to be able to, you know, say cannabis, for example, like it's legal in many places. So you qualify by, I have arthritis, I have, you know, these cancer, these types of things that qualify it as a approved treatment option.
Yeah, I will say in the state of Oregon, though, they're doing something really interesting in that they're not just exploring the approvals or having the approvals for psychedelic assisted therapy. So you need a diagnosis in order to do the therapy. They also are exploring adult use of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. So which you don't necessarily need a diagnosis to get access to the medicine or these substances to help you.
So what are your thoughts on that? Because I feel like people medicate with these drugs all the time. So, and it's been effective. I guess the difference is in the clinical setting, you have assistance in you know, how you work through it. But if you have a community and they're there for you, then it seems like, well, that 10,000, 20,000, however many thousand is really $500.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. So I am in full support of diverse models of care when it comes to working with psychedelics, that using psychedelics in an adult use way, which is how it's been described, or is basically just using psychedelics in the way that you want to use psychedelics. Like, I think it is, I am in full support of folks, yeah, using psychedelics in a way that they see fit. And just like you said, around community, that's one of my, how do I say this? One of the challenges that I see in using psychedelics in a retreat setting, and by retreat, I mean, if you live in the States and you go to the Netherlands, to have a psilocybin experience where it's intense. You may have two ceremonies and you meet people from all over the world and you're in this container for a week and then you go back home to the States to integrate your experience. That to me, there's enough can't be said of what it means to integrate with people in your own community. So like your friends, your family, if you have family that are open and willing to go through this experience with you, or just like your neighbors, the people that live nearby, that integration with people who know you and have known you for all of your life, if not decades or years, that integration looks a little different, a lot different than integration with people that you don't know. And then the integration may just be in an online setting. Here for that, there's a space for that. I'm not saying that that is not useful or necessary or important. What I'm saying is, as the psychedelic field continues to evolve, I would love to see more local ways, local use of psychedelics and or local integration in communities, because that's at least a way that I see change and transformation really being able to happen on a community level.
You said something interesting about ceremony. And so in training, in your, you know, working in training and that type of thing, how do you or do you integrate a concept of ceremony in your treatments?
Yes. So for me, it is important for me to, as a practitioner in the medicalized space, to find ways to honor and respect traditional use of these substances, indigenous use of these substances, without appropriating or without doing things that, you know, I don't have a lineage practice in. And so for me, what incorporating aspects of ceremony into the medical space, and also we'll just give a disclaimer here that I'm not like an expert in ceremony. I've attended a handful in my lifetime. A few things that I incorporate that even across many sites this is incorporated is the use of plants, live plants, fresh flowers,
nature.
That have soil, could be a grounding element in the space. I also, depending on the space, I can create something that looks like an altar. And of course, there's lots of limitations in a hospital setting of what you can do with that. But I do it in a way, again, as a gesture to honor the lineage of what we're coming into, because it's not just about the medicine. It's also about the container and the space that's created. And these are all elements of the space that gets created. Food is also part of that preparation and the setting of an intention. So offering someone the medicine or the substance where they use an intention as a guide or as an anchor to help support them in their journey. That these are some of the elements that I combine.
Nice. So that makes me wonder, if you could create your perfect therapy situation, perfect therapy setting, what would it be? What would it be like? You know, outside of a, you know, if it's outside, inside, out, any, what would it be?
So it definitely would be a space in nature. I don't know about having the dosing session in nature, not saying that it wouldn't happen, but I just have questions or curiosities about that. When you think about the environment and how that also will contribute to the journey that someone has. There would be, I would say, laughter and joy.
So it'd be a group setting. Typically.
Yeah, a group setting. A group setting. And again, a group setting where people know each other. So not just they met each other a week ago and are having this really deep, very vulnerable experience, but that there's been a relationship that you've developed with the people going into the space. Sure.
I mean, it's kind of like AA, right? Like the fact that you go to meetings and there's this group of people that kind of know you. And so that helps with the movement of your healing, I guess. The research has proved that when you're with people that you know, you become more vulnerable in a way that helps you to potentially explore more of what it is that you're looking to heal.
Yeah, outside of nature, group settings, like people knowing each other, these are kind of the main things that stand out to me in this time space with the knowledge that I have now. Yeah, maybe that will change, but yeah, based on what I've experienced, that these would be factors that at least feel like it would create a really safe and, how do I say, a safe and a container for healing.
Okay, sounds good. So I want to ask you about Glocal Speak, because we're talking about places and things of that nature. And so I want you to share a word, a phrase, or a saying that is a meaningful part of your local experience and why or how you come to value it as Glocal Speak. So it could be about anywhere that you felt local. And sometimes it's contextual to the kind of work you do.
So a phrase, a local phrase that resonates with me. I will say the first phrase that comes to mind is a phrase that my maternal grandfather used to say growing up, which was waste not, want not. And essentially, this phrase is a continual reminder for me that nothing in life is wasted. And that it truly appreciate the moment for what it is and not trying to arrive at some destination, that where you are here in the present moment, that nothing is wasted in that moment. Or even things that you think, if that wouldn't have happened, my life would have been different. Nothing. Waste not, want not.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that interpretation of it. Because, you know, typically people think it's like material, right? But yeah, that to the extent of it, that experience. I like that. Thank you for that. So let's talk about your work with the Women's Global Empowerment Initiative.
Oh,
yeah. Tell us more about that, how you came to it and where it stands.
Yes. So shout outs to Samantha Grayman, who is the leader of this initiative, as well as Rachel Kurt. So this nonprofit was born out of the desire to give more young women of color experience with going abroad. So specifically, we curated alongside our sister organization, Darcy Hamad, this intercultural educational program for teenage women of color in the Southeast United States to give them an opportunity to experience a different culture, this culture being Morocco. And we ran a few cohorts of students. We aren't running student or cohorts of students anymore, but it was really admirable to witness students go travel to Morocco from the States and really experience themselves in a different way. And for some of the students, that experience led them to do further studies in language learning or international, something with the intersection of international, whether it's law or medicine. And so it was, an organization that helped to provide an opportunity for young women of color in the South to have an experience abroad. They're an organization that is near and dear to my heart, for sure.
Nice. How did Morocco become the destination for your first works?
Yeah, so it was really, Morocco was chosen because Samantha, and I want to say Rachel too, they were Fulbright scholars.
Oh, okay.
And so in their scholarship program, Morocco was the place that they visited. Mm-hmm. And so it was, they already had built relationships with folks there. So it was more of an easier integration to choose Morocco.
But it's obviously replicable in any environment, you know, to the extent that you're now in the UK, that's also a place of potential interest. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that. So I want to ask you about a mindset hack. So what is your favorite or an innovative mindset hack? One that you know of, one that you can imagine? How do you hack your mindset? Or one that you practice?
I laugh because I'm like, I wish I had a mindset hack. Okay, that I practice that I could offer and share. So what I will maybe say is maybe less of a mindset hack and more of a body hack.
Oh, okay.
Which is using our breath.
Yes.
Which our breath is an ancient tool that we have available to us as long as we are present in this dimension. And so I find myself, if I'm feeling anxious or even excited, because sometimes both of these can be the same energy in a felt sense in your body, mm-hmm. and I'm wanting to slow down a bit, mm-hmm. that I elongate my exhales. And research shows that elongating your exhales can literally activate more relaxation in your body. And so using the breath, I would say, is a body hack that also has an impact on the mind. Also, if I'm thinking about just the way that I hold my body, if I'm anxious or excited, I tend to, you know, brace myself, shoulders tense, lean forward. Mm-hmm. And so another body hack to mind hack to slow down is to really relax into the chair that I'm sitting on, or relax into a seated position, or relax into the ground to really feel supported in the moments that I'm in. That these, I think, are two things that can, over time with practice, help to create some mind hacks, I'll say.
I agree. Breath work is, and I think for so many people, you know, I've tried so many different modalities of everything. And when I really come back to what works most globally, it's breath work, you know, really taking that time, holding your breath. And then, like you said, it helps you get in touch with what's going on in your body. Because when you're thinking about sending the breath to certain places, it's just this idea of like, I'm thinking about my elemental self, like oxygen is now touching this. And then, well, that's how I think about it. But yeah. I appreciate that. So yes, folks, breath work. I'll have some links to much of what Sarah's discussed in the conversation. And so before we get into the Sarah that's not working and not doing research and all of those things, I want to ask about your entrepreneurial pursuits. So Mind's Eye Health Solutions. Tell us about that work and the solutions that you offer.
Yeah, so Mind's Eye Health Solutions was born out of this curiosity of how can we make mental wellness more accessible in the world as we know it? And how can we utilize digital technology to support mental wellness? Because a lot of what is talked about on the internet is, oh, internets are a distraction, they're a way to escape, they're like self-soothing, self-comfort, which all of these are true, can be true. And it's like, well, if everybody's using their screens, how can we help support people who want to use screen time in a more proactive way? Is there even such a thing to using screen time in a more proactive way? And so that's where Mind's Eye Health was born out of. And I will be honest to say that the journey in funding the technology that we want to create has been a bit of a, how do I say? It's been a challenging process. Yes. And so because of that, we have parked our development of our technology for now. And so myself and the other co-founder, shout outs to Shamaya Holland, we're both taking a break and pursuing our own individual interests. So for her, this includes, I think she has like 5 restaurants now called the Peach Cobbler Factory in Kentucky. So if you are looking for a Black owned dessert place to occupy, please check out the Peach Cobbler Factory, both in Louisville and Lexington and in Southern Indiana.
Okay.
And for me, I have a super small private practice where I see folks online and still work with ketamine. And I also am starting to address a need that I've seen for years in the psychedelic space, which is around the importance of culturally sensitive practices, mm-hmm. and how do we incorporate more cultural sensitivity in our approach to working with psychedelics in the medicine space, mm-hmm. or in this medicalized space. So part of my entrepreneurial pursuits now includes creating this course. So if folks are practitioners, or if you're interested in learning more about cultural sensitivity in psychedelic sessions, feel free to check me out on my website and subscribe so you can stay up to date on the launching of those courses. And also feel free to subscribe in general just to stay in the loop on what's happening with me.
Nice. Yes, I hear you 100% on the funding. That is a huge challenge, particularly for founders of color, in digital spaces. So I can think of, I work with and talk with different types of investors. So if you're interested, I will give you some leads on potential. Because I think potentially, I think the times are changing. And I say definitely in the last few years, there's definitely kind of another visibility that founders of color in the digital space are starting to have access to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely here to check out the potential leads.
Wonderful. So we'll take care of that offline. Getting, I know you got to get on to that entrepreneurial pursuit. And so I want to ask you, who is Sarah when she's not working? And are you a reader? Are you a watcher? Or are you a listener? And what are some of your favorite reads, watches, or listens?
Who is Sarah beyond her entrepreneurial professional pursuits? Sarah is a singer.
Hey, okay, nice. Now,
Sarah is not, you know, Jennifer Hudson or, the late Whitney Houston. But, I do my own rendition of the things and have a great time.
Nice. So is it karaoke do you do karaoke a lot?
It is karaoke, like solo by myself. So I'm at home with my fish and we are having a beautiful time singing songs and hitting all of the good and bad notes.
Okay. It's practice, right?
Sarah is also a piano player. Hmm. So used to play the piano, been playing the piano since I was 6 years old. And just now I'm getting back more into a practice of that. And my grandmother passed away recently and she was the best pianist I've ever heard in my life. And she would really combine different genres of music. So classical with gospel, with jazz and gospel. Like she really was an incredible pianist. And so my way of staying in connection with her and processing grief and also just staying creative is also includes me playing the piano. Sarah is also, is someone who's trying to keep her plants alive, which there are a couple of plants who I need to reach out to my cousin to see what I can do to help support them and revive them in spring.
Okay. Those are great. Those are great, great other pastimes. Well, Sarah, this has been so lovely. It's been great meeting you, great finding insights into the psychedelic therapy community and just everything that you're working on. And so before we say sign off for today, are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with the audience?
No final thoughts. Just appreciating this conversation and hope to be in touch with anyone who has questions or if anything that I shared resonates.
And where can we find you?
Yes, you can find me at sarahjreed.info. That's sarahjreed.info. And that's my website, but you can also find me on LinkedIn. Although I will say I don't check LinkedIn that often.
Now.
But,
but you will.
Exactly. But if you find me on there, I am happy to engage in a conversation.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so, so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
All right, listeners, this has been another episode of the podcast. You can catch us Tuesdays with new episodes at globalcitizens.com or wherever you get your podcast. Please do check the show notes, leave us a review, and just be well. It's a beautiful day. Just remember that. Until next time, bye for now.